through the start of every view, want that to keep that from some of our questions.
The national part of the presentation still needs to be done, so the maybe later to the topic, maybe now, then maybe after now, or maybe just individual questions always be dealt with in the presentation.
Thank you, Chair. Let me speak to my questions that are more relevant to local government and to the region as well. The first one is that you will recall the whole debate about the regional electricity distributors, the rates. And eventually that plan was abandoned. But it seems to me as if some of the necessary adjustments in policy, but also in the transfer of assets, etc., never happened after that. To illustrate, for example, we will still find Eskom providing some customers within a municipal area directly with electricity. Eskom as a retailer of electricity, whereas, you know, just a kilometer down the road, it would be the municipality providing customers with all the, you know, complications of having different tariffs, of people phoning the wrong body if the street lights go down, or the etc. And my question is just, and you've just confirmed informally to me that in the Western Cape you have a very good customer base in terms of the municipalities paying for their electricity. Would Eskom be willing to transfer their assets to the municipalities? And by the way, electricity for the municipalities is a valuable source of income, as well as a valuable tool to get a consumer to come and talk to them. Because the moment you can't buy electricity before a blockage is addressed, you know, so the municipalities, I'm sorry to say, abuse electricity, but they use what they have. The second one is also just informed in discussion, that's the whole issue of backyarders. And I was delighted to hear from you that it seems to me that there may be official approval to install a second metering point on a plot. Now, as we've just confirmed, in some cases, you know, you have five families on one plot. Now, what are the options then also for people to resell, to measure, to meter or to measure the electricity and then to resell, or then alternatively, and here comes in the whole issue of the so-called equity grant from central fiscus, where people are able to get that little bit of free electricity for more than one family, as I believe the policy was designed with one family in mind. Thank you, Chair. My other questions are more of a general national level.
Any other questions? Okay. I
can
have some questions. It is my understanding that Transnet wants something to do with the pipelines and the infrastructure parts that either need to be maintained or need to be put in and so on, and the Saldanha Bay region, in order to import liquid natural gas. I wanted to find out, could you please explain that, what specifically is happening there, and what specifically still needs to be done in order to import liquid natural gas through the Saldanha Bay port. Then I want to find out, in an oral question to the Minister of Economic Opportunities and Tourism in the Western Cape, he indicated that the battery storage development project underway in the Western Cape is 5. It reads 5.1 in the presentation, the battery storage development project. And then, in terms of UNCLOS specifically, what would be necessary for UNCLOS to move from the diesel to gas? And you've mentioned Corequa also previously, what would be also the necessary for Corequa to move from diesel to gas? I cannot remember the exact figure, But previously, with the MG game changer briefing, I was quite a high figure of the amount of economic growth that will take place in the Western Cape if we can move from diesel to gas, in terms of the cost savings and the economic development. So I would just like for you to speak about that, please. And I'll leave the questions about Section 34 determination for the minister, because the reason I invited him to come was specifically because the legislation speaks about ministerial determination that he has to make the determination. So I'll keep those for when I invite him again in November. You can speak about that, please.
Thank you, Chair. So just the question around variance in the getting the supply. So what currently happens is that the municipalities apply to the regulator if they want to take over the getting the supply. They also write the listing simultaneously. We then take a position on that and respond to both the municipality and the regulator on it. There are a couple of things that we consider. One is we look at, obviously, what is the network infrastructure in that area? If the dominant network infrastructure in that area is Eskom, we typically go back and say, you know, the biggest part of the network actually belongs to Eskom. And logically, you know, we've got to look at what is going to be the best for the consumer in this area. If the reverse is true and we've got a pocket in an area of supply of municipality and they have the bulk of it, we write back and give them an indication of what that infrastructure is like. I'll give a good example of what we've done in the Western Cape with the city of Cape Town. We had an area that we supplied, Nyanga, which was literally in the heart of the metro area, surrounded mainly by city of Cape Town network. The city of Cape Town was supplying an area called Solaris Village, which was a pocket in the Eskom supply area. Between the city and ourselves, we agreed to transfer the two areas. So the city took over Nyanga and Eskom took over Solaris Village, which is quite an amicable solution, and the customer impact was quite low because the customer didn't see any change. I think by virtue of the way the industry is structured, and unless you have that industry restructure taking place, I think you will constantly sit through this battle of different tariffs. And so we know it's the reality that customers on either side of the road end up paying different tariffs. From an Eskom perspective, obviously, I think the driver here has to be the industry restructure that takes place. But as municipalities apply to areas of supply, we actually deal with them on a case-by-case basis. And Chair, the second question around the backyard dwellers and the issue around refilling and obviously the grant. At the moment, the Department of Energy, which really regulates the policy around electrification for Eskom, is only allowed for an additional form of supply, one form of supply. So we've got the primary earth, which we supply, and then we can give an additional form of supply. What we have found, though, in reality, is that there are two shacks, or there are two windy houses on a property. And so effectively, you only supply one of the two with a formalized form of supply. The other one that takes a lead, you know how that works. The regulator does not allow a customer to refill. Legally, there are only two refillers of electricity. One is Eskom and the other will be a municipality. There should be no other refillers in the market. So legally, it should not be happening. But we do know practically what happens. The person owning the house is charging the people at the back in the shacks a tariff that no one knows how they came up with it, and when we have a problem is when we go there, we discover that people are being charged a fixed rate for the month. Whether you use it or not, that's what you pay for your electricity. So that's technically illegal. And we have asked people to rather report that to us so we can put in the meter for it. The backyard dwellers does not get the benefit unless they meet the customer of the free electricity, the FE, the free electricity. Because it's only the point of supply that is registered that actually qualifies for the free basic electricity. Now, Chair, it does create another problem even for the owner of the house. So what happens is you've got to consume a certain amount of energy or less to qualify for the fee-based electricity. But because you only have one meter point, but you've actually got two families on the property, that consumption level is actually quite high. So that initial customer that registers also finds that they don't qualify because their total consumption is higher than what is actually allowed for in terms of fee-based electricity. So when you start to use, you know, the sort of informal way of identifying people, backup lines, you lose the benefit of the fee-based electricity, both for the initial customer and for the backup lines. Chair, the question that you asked around the Ankerlift and the Tetcook option, we were having some discussions here with Brad, maybe Jan can comment on that.
Thank you, Jefferson. As I mentioned earlier, it's my understanding, and I need to follow up on this, that our project development section has been given, has been given a mandate by Eskom Exco to look at sourcing of primary energy, the gas versus diesel. What the progress is, I cannot unfortunately give you feedback, and I can find out and I can let you know. However, I have a discussion here back that I will make sure from our side that we get in contact with, we have a camp, perhaps apply and assist, and I will also then have a discussion with Transnet to take it forward. But it just makes sense that we get a solution in terms of gas because it's so much cheaper, and then we can increase, you know, the supply.
So,
can
I have a follow-up? And to find out, so the pipelines, are they already built or not built?
Non-existent.
The pipelines need to be built.
Great.
Okay. Once the pipelines are built, we can then through the pipelines import the natural gas.
Provided it will satisfy the volumes being required.
How much volume do you need?
I don't know, unfortunately.
In that same light, Chair, the reaffirmation from the CEO is that the Eskom ECCO has already given an indication to or a mandate to the authorities around this particular matter of sourcing gas and supply.
That's correct, Chairperson. That is to obtain sources of gas, then provide a business case to bring back to ESCO that we can then assess and make a decision based on that. That's correct.
Other
questions? Thank you, Chair. Can I go back? It's always been my understanding that the Western Cape is a net importer of electricity, if I can use those words. You've just said that the distribution cost is about 30%. I presume that only a small portion of that is for the transmission of electricity, let's say, from Mpumalanga to the Western Cape. But let's assume that it's perhaps one third of that 30%. So when you consider the cost of electricity in the Western Cape that can be locally produced by IPPs or other sources of electricity, should we not then also, as part of our calculations, bring in the cost of the distribution, the long distance distribution of electricity to the Western Cape? That's the first point. The second one is, are we, because obviously as politicians we also look at the risk for the province, is the province at any risk, for example, of, let's call it sabotage or then a major failure of infrastructure because of the fact that we have so little capacity of our own and that we are so reliant on big electricity producers elsewhere in the country?
In terms of to determine the tariff, we look at Eskom's total investment. So what it's costing to generate an electron and what it means to get it onto the network, the grid, and then out to the server. terms of, so that's where the conflict comes. So are you dependent on Mpumalanga? I think you're dependent on the national grid performing the way it's designed to perform. To come back to an important question and comment that you've made, sabotage and vandalism. It's becoming a reality that vandals take angle grinders or whatever and they go and cut down these transmission towers and distribution towers and then cut a few members out of that and go and sell it for a couple of rand, then costing, you know, less than millions. So there's always the risk that one of these big pipes, if I can say a pipe, all the way from Mpumalanga, bringing all the electrons down to the Cape, so to speak, that if we can lose one of those lines. So then it will be a catastrophe. However, we have identified this risk. We also, as Eskom, are fully aware that when you talk about load shedding, that means you cannot supply enough for a specific period and maybe for a day or two. You know, that 2 hours when you know, the mothers and the women need to make food and all these sort of things, at that time when the demand is high, that there's no electricity. But that continued for a day, maybe two or so, and when we've resolved the issue, the power is back. And I've made it very clear to wherever I go, and it's important to understand it here as well, that load shedding or the risk is not only on the generation part, it is also on these lines. If you lose one of these lines, a strategic line going down, that may mean that you're going to have no power to millions of people for days. So it's important to understand the risk within the value chain, generation, transmission and distribution. And this is why we are putting a lot of focus not only on generation, but also on the wire side of the business, which is the major transmission lines as well as distribution. So it's a holistic approach to the value chain, generating the electrons, transmitted and to distribute. That's an important principle to understand. That load shedding is not desirable and it's costing the country an arm and a leg every day we have it. But the risk is not only there, the risk is also in the wire side.
Chair, can I maybe also just offer some comments to the committee? In 2008 and 2006, when we had the load shedding in the Western Cape, one of our stakeholders, or one of the things that we didn't see, was the fact that we had also lost. We had 1,400 kV transmission line out of service because we were maintaining, and then because the load had shifted onto the other one, we actually lost that line. Subsequent to that, over the last few years, we built 2765 kV lines into the Cape. So effectively the Cape has got sufficient capacity to carry load anywhere in the north of the country down to the Cape. So we've got 2765 kV lines and we have the 2400 that we had initially installed. So we effectively have tripled the capacity for us to actually move energy into the Cape. Should we use the 400, we've got absolutely zero risk in terms of load shedding the Cape. I do think that the point made by the CEO is that load shedding can occur either because of a shortage of generation or your inability to supply the customer because you've lost the line. So the focus at the moment is to make sure that the lines of transmission and distribution do not become the cause of load shedding. And that's why we focus on maintaining this and investing in our infrastructure.
So if I may, perhaps just to... It's important to say this as well. If you take the Northern Cape and if you take the Eastern Cape, we have projects, investment projects that has been approved that will be rolled out in the next few years that will provide parallel paths from Mpumalanga through the Northern Cape to the Western Cape and through the Eastern Cape to the Western Cape. So just to comment as well.
Chairman, one question you asked, you wanted us to affirm whether the project status for Bed 5 and Tractor 1 that the MEC had also seen is shared on that project.
Okay, thank you. With that, we move to the next slide.
Thank you, Jefferson. I will deal with the issues that we haven't spoken about yet. And if you will allow me, I would rather briefly go through this and allow questions, because I'm sure there will be questions. So that's right, Chair. Let's talk about Edward's debt. Eskom currently our debt, let me recap. Let's start with the income statement and the balance sheet. I think it's important. On the income statement, our revenue is about 190 billion per annum. Our expenses is about 160 billion per annum. So we make an EBITDA profit of 30 billion per annum. So we're making a profit. However, then what comes in is on the balance sheet, our debt. So we had to borrow quite a lot of money, 450 billion to be precise, to run the operations over a number of years, to build the country, to build Kusile, to build Ingula, to build all these transmission lines and substations, to evacuate the power, etc. So on the balance sheet, we have a debt of 450 billion, which requires per annum 70 billion plus in finance and infrastructure. So you make 30 billion profit, but you've got to pay 70. So immediately there's a negative. But then it doesn't stop, and I'll deal with it with a debt now. On the balance sheet, it doesn't stop with only the debt that we had to borrow. But there's also a line item called outstanding debt, which refers to the municipalities not paying Eskom, and I assure you, if you watch TV this morning, and then also a city called Soweto. Between Soweto, which is close to 20 billion, and the outstanding municipality, 25 billion, we are owed 45 billion. Now, what makes it extremely frightening is that the Munich debt has grown the last 2 months by 3 billion net alone. So you sit with a 30 billion profit EBITDA that you're making. You've got to pay 70 billion back, but then there's also people not paying you for what you make available. So that is put us in a very tight financial situation. And as you, as business people, will know, you cannot get yourself out of this. You cannot, if you're only making 30 billion, you've got to pay back 70 billion, people not paying you for what you generate. And then over and above that, we still need to go and borrow this year another 46 billion to run the operations. So that is going to take us half a trillion rand, 500 billion. And if you have 500 billion, your payback is 85 billion. And your sales volume is exactly the same. So the only little bit of revenue that is more is because of tax. So because of this situation that we find ourselves in, the shareholder has decided to make available a CRO, a chief restructuring officer, to us. This individual has started, he's putting his team together and to find ways on how to deal with this 450 billion that will go to 500 billion, on how to deal with it. So it's a significant challenge that is considered. Now one asks, you know, where is this coming from? And I'll just give you a little bit. Eskom has built 3 power plants, still in the process of building some of it, but in Gula, when we went to the board, that was presented about 15 billion, it was double that we got. When we presented Medupi, it was 78 billion, it's going to cost us, I would guess, about 145, although it's not cost of completion, finalized. And that excludes the FGD, which is another 40 billion. Then Kusile initially was 82.5 billion, that's going to go to 160 billion. So if you take 160, 140, and another 50, that you get 350 billion rand, which Eskom had to fund themselves. And then whenever you build a power station, you have to build a line, some substations to evacuate the power. So this is where Eskom finds itself. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have inefficiencies. I'm not saying that we are very productive. We have our internal challenges that we have to deal with. We also have to deal with our expenses, which has increased over the last 10 years. And we have plans and programs in place to deal with it. So one of the things is to take 33 billion out over the next 4 years out of our costs on a permanent basis. So we are focused to deal with the income statement. And I believe that the first focus is to take the 50 billion and make it 60 billion. And that's what we like. But the 60 billion is not going to be enough if you have to pay 85 billion. And that is an important thing to understand. So we need debt relief, somebody that can assist us. That's what we ask the shareholder to do, to please assist us with the debt relief. So we have significant financial challenges. As I said earlier, coal is primary energy, coal is a challenge. We have started to engage through the Department of Public Enterprises and Minerals and Energy to talk to the mines. To say, please, we need to have a look at the input cost of this. Because if we need to pay our EBITDA and we need to double it at least. And then if we can get debt relief, let's assume just half of it, we can take the 80 down to 40. If you can make 60 minus 40, then you've got 20 billion. Then you don't have to go and borrow money for the investments, the green lines, you know, all these things. Because currently, although the government is helping us with 23 billion and another 26 billion this year, it is not sufficient. We still have to go and borrow another 26. And at this point in time, I've spoken to the CFO, and the two of us are quite nervous. And it's just demonstrating now, as this municipal debt is going, it means we need to go and borrow more. So it's a very difficult financial situation that Eskom finds itself. And we are very aware of the fact that we are, I suppose, the biggest risk to the country's fiscal system. So we understand that. And we are responsible to see how we can deal with that. And this is why we can have a direct impact, which is on the income statement, is to do exactly that. And we have requested now assistance from the political side, government side, to assist us. At this point in time, it's getting out of control. It's really getting out of control. We started with a financial year, which was the 1st of April, on 19.6 billion. Now we're at 55 billion. And if we continue at this rate, Caleb is not going to borrow 46 billion. He's going to borrow more than 50. So it's a serious challenge. Just on the system status update, we have about 45,000 megawatts that we have installed, of which 3,000 is in coal environment, 2,000 nuclear, 3,000 gas, and then some IPPs that is assisting us. However, as I mentioned earlier, because of the unpredictability and unreliability of our plant, specifically on the coal side, on average, 7,500 to 8,000 megawatts every day is not available. There may be full load losses, partial load losses, as well as including our planned maintenance. So it's an everyday exercise to balance demand versus supply. Because during the summer where we are now, we tend to take more opportunity to maintain our plant. And so it's every day it's a balancing act to see how we do. This morning when I woke up every morning at 5 o'clock, I get the system status, how does it look, what happened overnight, what is the outlook for the day, and then I get an update every 4 hours on how it's looking. So today, extremely well. But I'm going to stop saying this because every time I say this, probably without challenges either day, but it was felt. But I actually give the credit to my colleagues within the organization, understanding the impact on the economy of the country and working dedicated people working very hard to solve the issue. The graph on the screen is just demonstrating how where we're standing at this point in time up until beginning of December and then for the Christmas break will go down. So during that time we will spend a lot of time to do some more maintenance. Currently about 5,000 to 6,000 megawatts per on average per day, and we could want to push up during that period to 8,000 to 9,000 megawatts. So that is to take that old car. Now you have time to stop, you can take it to the garage, you can get mechanics, you can work on the car, you can replace what you need to replace, and when it's time and ready, then you can drive again. So this is just demonstrating you typically on a week of the day, what does that mean in terms of that 8,000, 10,000 I was talking. It's just how we distinguish between what is unplanned, what is planned, and then there's a thing called OCGT, others, that is typically in November, up in the July, when it's hot day, we can lose up to 1,000 megawatts of battery losses per day. So, Chairperson, I think in a nutshell, the system is fine. As I said earlier, the risk of load shedding remains. However, we understand the responsibility that we have as ESCOM. We understand the impact on the economy of the country. And we will do whatever we can to make sure that we don't have to load shed. That may mean that we may be burning more diesel than what we anticipate, and that we will be using water reserves as well. But we understand, and load shedding is the absolute if we cannot. And when there's a risk in the system, then we will load shed. So, in a nutshell, that's where we're from. Thanks, Jim.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Rosa. Mr. Rosa, thank you for the images that you've used, or the language that you've used to explain this, the old body and then the old car. Those are all things I can relate to quite well. But my question is, in a sense, when you're driving your equipment hard, when you're utilizing every single ounce of capacity that you have, isn't that when you should be at your most economical, rather than having a lot of redundancy and capital tied up in assets that are, you know, not being utilized because they're only there for their reserve capacity, etc. And therefore, you know, if we find that the electricity prices are going up at the rate that they've been going up, while we are utilizing our assets to the fullest extent possible, how does the future then look for the country such as South Africa? Second to that, in the briefing that we've had, you know, when we speak about renewable energy capability and capacity, we always use the term installed capacity. There's so much available. And the same with your coal plants and your general generating capacity. And I've heard that, you know, in general, because of the age of our coal plants, that they are running under the industry norms, international industry norms. So my second question is, when we talk about when we talk about the efficiency or the utilization, I think you know what I'm coming at, what is the actual power that we're getting from our renewable energy sources? You know, when we say there's 400 megawatt, how much do they really contribute in effect? Then also, if you could just perhaps help us, very few organizations have been so much under the spotlight or magnifying glass as ESCOM has been over the last few years, with a lot of experts commenting on ESCOM. And what we hear is that the general salary per staff member is exorbitantly high. We hear about high levels of corruption. You have, for example, now referred to the high cost of transporting coal to fuel power stations. When it's my impression that in the past, quite often you made use of conveyor belts rather than road transport, etc. So, what is the future in that regard? Because, and you know, I've heard horrendous stories of power plants. You know how much coal you need to generate a certain amount of electricity, for example. And that some of these plants, suddenly you buy a lot more coal than what in the past you needed to generate the same. So either the coal is of a substandard, or people are claiming that they've delivered 40 tons of coal, but you've actually only received 50 tons of coal. Things like that. So my question is that the cost of poor management, the cost of corruption, and you've now referred to the cost of vandalism, but there's also the cost of supply chain management processes. If you could just help us to understand, are those things under control, or can you assure today that those things will be brought under control? And then lastly, and it's more of a policy question, what is your stance on competition in general, in terms of electricity generation? Because that is where the debate has been going for a while. And I've recently been introduced to a new term which, if I remember correctly, is called wheeling, where electricity is taken from, generated from one point and it's been consumed or sold to another person at another point. But it has to make use of either the municipal grid or the Eskom grid. If you could just tell us what in terms of policy, where does Eskom stand?
My question is actually the third cover for the last speaker. I'm just going to go through the most critical points that I made to find out all the designers. You have made mention that you are trying to borrow about 400 billion for just for operations. Do you think Eskom will ever be able to recover from financial crisis? And number two, how much percentage of your debt anyway for corrupt activities in your department? Having known the issue of Eskom being out of the domain about their operations and poor management of the business. Thank you.
Thank you. Given the explanation of the percentage of municipality debt and community debt, I want to specifically ask about the attempts that we've been told for about a couple of years now that the government has tried to engage municipalities to pay. Is that hearing any of still some trying to reduce their debt, still some not. What are the efforts yielding to, if any, into the future of this company, what you currently have, which is about 25 years. And then the conversation that also I think has been spoken about, and I think also in the paper of Minister Adidon Wing, that you can just shed light about the answer to Kalanik as a world of possibility. What that is, as a strategy, because you said you need an intervention to explain that the situation is highly precarious. What is that? And what kind of internal conversation amongst Eskom and given this unique, this potential instability, what are the conversations that are taking place and issues related?
saying that Holland brought some wood into the country. Against all the challenges we have in terms of population, towards the town, you know, because the fear, you know, the type of instability that may be presented, you know, by the different interventions to rescue the business.
Thank you, Jim. To come back to the question that we're running the old bodies out, that is correct. However, I believe Jefferson, what I need to also explain, your fleet is only so many old cars. And to transport whatever you need to transport, you need to use all these cars. So you don't have the luxury to take one of these cars and put it in the garage and get the mechanics to fix it. Because it needs to run all of them all the time to from A to B to transport whatever needs there. So it's important to understand that although we have a lot of cars, the demand for these cars are so high that it has to run all the time. And this is where the huge challenge is coming for Eskom, is that we don't have at any given time the luxury to take 3 or 5 units and say, this needs to be done for the next 20 days or 21 days, whatever the case may be, so let's fix it. It has to run. So it's important to understand that dilemma that we are facing. So that's one. The question on the energy availability factor, that was the one that you referred to. So what is the availability of these units that we have? So these cars, how available are they percentage-wise out of 100 at all times to take whatever from A to B? Now, in the 80s, the early 80s, 90s, early 90s, we were running at an 80% availability. So then you had the luxury that whenever the demand is low, you can take the expensive cars and you can park them and you can run with the cheap cars. So you park the Mercedes-Benz and you drive with the Vito. Another Vito, a Polo, I can say. That is more economic too. Now that 80% availability, so what we have, we said, we had 80% availability, a 10% unavailability, and a 10% on planned outage. What has happened now? That 80% came down to 70. And your 10% unavailability has now increased to nearly 20%. And this is where we need to work on that 20% to get it back to the 10%, that you can then pick up your 70 again total. Now, we are in a debate, is it possible with the old bodies that we have? We believe it is, and we need to work hard at that. However, now the question is, so these bodies are getting older and older, just now this car needs to retire. It's got to go now to the scrapyard or whatever occasion, or to the graveyard, and maybe better. We have now built Kusile and Ruby. So those two, where a typical power station from Mpumalanga, if you can recall, being referred to as a six-pack. Six units of 600 megawatts. Here we have six units of 800 megawatts. So between these two power stations, we nearly have 10,000 megawatts. Now there's always the understanding that we're going to build the new ones, so when the old ones are coming to end of life, that we will still have sufficient capacity. However, now we have challenges with the new stations. So we have some latent effects, which we are dealing with. We have implemented at Madupi, where we, I'm very proud to say, in the next 2 weeks, the fifth unit will come into commercial operation, and then there's only one outstanding unit, which we plan for the middle of next year. So then Madupi will come to the end of construction period. However, with all the latent defects and engineering challenges, we've implemented quite a number. technical solutions, and it seems that it's moving positively forward. And it's now to make sure that whenever we have the opportunity that we can take one of these new units out and do all the modifications that is required. So we believe by the next 4 or 5 years, these two power stations will be turning the way it has been designed. I will not say what we've invested so, but the way it has been designed and been paid for. Because soon, we are looking now at 3 power stations, Grootvlei, Komati, and Indrina, that is coming to end of life. So in the next 3 or 4 years, those units will, power stations will come to end of life. Although with the challenges we have now, we are looking at these power stations, which of those we can extend a little bit, what makes economic sense. So it's just finding some feedback. What is also important is you were talking about coal. When this time last year, we were running extremely low. We were on average 20 days coal. So there was a real risk that we will have load shedding because we had no coal in it. Now again, we placed a lot of contracts, 41 contracts to be precise. We've been short and medium term contracts, anything between 3 to 5, 8 years. Obviously, it was coming at a price because everybody was knowing at the time Eskom needs coal. So it's supply and demand. You know, if there are lots of people that would like to buy one house, the price goes up. That's where we found ourselves. But we're dealing with those issues now. Now, I'm proud to say when I had a look late last night, we're standing on 55 days now. And there's not a single power station that is below the zip code of 20 days. So in terms of volumes, we have the volumes now. Now we're coming to the question that you have. The miners are also not playing ball. Because they knew that Eskom was needing volumes, we also, maybe they didn't understand we cannot burn rocks and steam, but so that comes back to the controls on Eskom's side that is not sufficient. So the focus has now moved from volume, although we maintain that specific focus on volume of coal, to the quality of coal. And to make sure that what we're paying for is what we're receiving. Because as soon as you burn a low quality coal, it has an impact on more ash, more partial load losses, so we need to get that under control. We are investing now quite a lot of money to mechanize and automate some of the systems that we have in place. So on the one side, the volumes are there now, the focus is on to get the quality. Then the question on experts. Eskom is experts. But I suppose we have ourselves to blame. You know, we keep quiet and other people start talking. So we've realized in Eskom that the shortcomings that we have, that we need to communicate more. Yesterday when we had the board social, ethical and sustainability board supplementary meeting, we discussed that again. The issue of salaries. We had a discussion the other day on possible increase for our senior leadership. And what you will see in the news, I suppose, today, because the email came out yesterday, and as soon as the email is out, it's public knowledge for that trust, that we are giving 2.8% to our executives in the organization. When we did the study, we saw that our executives are market related at this point. So we are comfortable that there's not a lot of fat cats sitting that has been referred to, you know, the fat cats in Mayweather Park. So we are comfortable that on average we are market related, and in some of the areas we are below market. There was also a question that I saw on the big bonuses. No bonuses have been paid to any executive last year. There's no bonuses that will be paid to any executive this year. There will be no increase in the salaries of the senior executives like myself. So for the second year in a row, I will have no salary increase. Bonuses, it's not something we even talk about. And there will also be no increase in the board membership. So we've taken note of the fact that we're going to going through a difficult financial time, and we are responsible in dealing with those issues. However, you had a question on corruption. Do we have corruption in Eskom? Yes, we have. Are we aware of all the corrupt activities? No, we're not. Because it's not only at the senior level, it is throughout the organization. And you cannot only ring-fence it to procurement or only to group capital, it is throughout the organization. Are we dealing with it? Yes, decisively, wherever we find any whistleblower or if we get wind of any corrupt activities, we are dealing with that decisively. That I can give you without any wink of my eyes, we are dealing with this. I personally am working with the Special Investigating Unit, as well as the Forfeiting Unit, as well as Hawke's National Prosecuting Authority. So we are dealing with this. However, it makes it difficult. You find within the organization some malfeasance, you deal with that in terms of your disciplinary code, and as soon as you get to a stage that the individual resigns, and then you take the file and you hand it over to the authorities. And that's where it becomes difficult. On our group capital side, there was a question, how much money have we lost in terms of looping? We don't know. It's billions. There's no doubt about it. It's billions and billions. Some, we've got five companies that we're investigating. I'm not going to mention the names at this point in time. At Cecilia Power Station, which we believe we've overpaid more than 4 billion rand. And how do you overpay somebody? The contractor must have submitted an invoice. Eskom should have had a look and say, this has been done. Yes, sign it off. So, corrupt activities. So we are dealing with these issues wherever we can. It takes time. And it is so entrenched in the organization. But we've dealt with a lot of issues. The SIU, I think it's so much as I said. So the SIU is dealing with the issues. Competition and the issue of winning. What is Eskom's view on competition? I believe Eskom is responsible to say if there is competition, a cost-effective tariff for the country, it is the benefit. We as Eskom not need to be concerned about competition. We need to get our thousand oil and produce a cost-effective product to the country of South Africa to make sure that we attract investment, that the product that we have available for the country is reliable and is needed. In terms of wheeling, currently wheeling is whenever you generate something and you wheel it through a another system or another network. Currently we are exporting power to Zimbabwe, as well as to Namibia, Botswana, as well as to Mozambique. So that's where the wheeling gets into consideration. And when you start talking about wheeling, then you pay a certain amount of money to make use of that network to get the power. Cover of the 450 billion, that will be recovered from there. The only way we believe at this point in time, the major ways of dealing with the 450 is to get relief. To get the 450 or half billion, or 500 billion, to get it to something that, based on what our EBITDA is, that we can pay back. Still have a positive that we can invest positive to in our networks or in the supply. So the price of corruption is a difficult one to quantify, but it is really important. I have a saying that greed is an untreatable disease. You cannot treat greed. So we don't know that. Munich debt, how do we deal with Munich debt? It's a difficult one. Like in the case of Newcastle yesterday. So whenever we are not getting paid, we engage, and Obi can talk about this in much more detail. My days when I was in this chair a long time, but it's tough. when you engage in state regional space, there's a contract in place. And if there is no movement, then you provide a notice of termination. We're going to terminate. And then some of these municipalities are very clever and very mystic. So they get the power from us, they don't pay us. But they get their customers are paying them. So what they then do, as soon as we issue them with termination, interrupt the supply, they take those notifications to the paying customer and say, look what Eskom wants to do. And then these customers go to court and they get the interdict that we cannot interrupt the supply. So it makes it extremely difficult. Now we are in negotiation and in close discussion, deep discussion with the other ministerial government departments, and we've also tabled this now at the table of our own minister of public enterprise that we need now to engage, because we believe that and if we get political assistance, we can move forward. So at this point in time, it's a very difficult thing. We have already attached some of the assets and so on, but it doesn't take you to the buildings that you have control of. So it's really a difficult issue, but it's an issue that needs to be dealt with decisively, because it has a significant negative impact on the finances, not only of Eskom, but of the country. You know, somehow we need to deal with the issue of the entitlement. I am entitled. So it's a difficult thing to deal with. Human capital, before I get to the unbundling one, how do we deal with our people? We sincerely believe, and I believe, that our people is our most important asset. If you don't have people, you can have all the machines in the world that is running, but if you don't maintain and look after them and operate them. So Eskom is going through a tough time with the uncertainty, with operational challenges, financial challenges, the issue that we cannot give the increases and the bonuses that the people are used to, like in the past, it is difficult. So personally, myself, I have job engagements throughout the country 3 times per month, where I go and talk to people and give hope. Because I believe that that is important. And do I believe we can solve the issues in Eskom? Yes, I believe so. It's going to take dedication, hard work, and it's going to be fun. That we can solve. Our interim executive chairman, which is also the acting group chief executive, he's going and doing exactly the same 2 to 3 times per month. He's going as well and talk to people to get the morale to where it's supposed to be, to make people feel that they're important, because they are. Without the people, Eskom doesn't exist. And it's to get the people to understand that and appreciate that, and that leaders within Eskom demonstrate the leadership, why they're getting paid for, to be the leaders, and being a leader is to engage with people, to listen to you, people, paint the picture, give feedback, do performance management, just the things that involve the team, that we know we're in tough spots, but we will take it through. We've been in tough spots before, not where we are now, and we've successfully been through this, but we need now to get the people behind us. Unbundling, Chairperson, this is And this makes our people get nervous. At the end of last year, we at Eskom had a look at our operational as well as financial performance and said, we've got to do something. So at Eskom Exco, we presented in November last year, 11 months ago, to the board, that we believe we've got to change the way we're running Eskom. Because somehow, over the last 10 years, Eskom decided to take away the authority, and he will testify to this, to take away the authority from the line managers. So procurement, HR, finance, logistics, you name it, everything reported to head office. Even in running the Western Cape distribution operating unit, the people that were supporting him reported to me were 1,000 miles from him, 1,400 kilometers. So we've decided that accountability needs to go back to the line managers and hold them accountable. Because in the past it was too easy for when you say that what's happening here, to say it's megawatt park, talk to Megan Park, they sent out a certificate. So we've got no clear account of it. So we decided then distribution, transmission and generation will be run as businesses within the ESCO umbrella and be measured on profitability, profit and loss. If that was then presented to board, board accepted that, and then obviously a very small head office. And the board then presented that to the shareholder, and the president then reflected the nation on in February, the beginning of the year, then talked about unbundling. And what unbundling basically means is what we had in mind to reinvent, but then also to take these units and make them separate legal entities initially within the umbrella of ESCO. And then for the shareholder, depending on the needs of the industry, the electricity industry, energy industry, then to make decisions moving forward. So we're going around and talk to our staff, our colleagues, and say to them, it is about just going back to the turn of the century when ESCOM in 2003 and 4 were voted the best utility in the world by its peers. Because that's where the accountability was, with the line managers. And that's where we said we can go. So this is where we stand with unbundling. We're getting ready now, and we've moved already progress to have these green fence, distribution, transmission, as well as generation. And then at the same time, we've started now the legal the process to make them legal entities. And then in time to come, we believe it's going to take 2 to 3 years to get there. And then it's for the shareholder, then together with ESCOM and the board, to say, while engaging the industry of South Africa, to say, what is the best model for the South African industry in terms of interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick one to Ross. Do you know who the third name is on the shortlist for the CEO position?
Any other follow-up? Not really follow-up, okay. I have a question, please. You spoke earlier about overpaying for Kutila in Madupi. How much were you supposed to pay for Kutila in Madupi, and how much did you pay? Okay. Then, I'm going back to Uncle Lutton for example. If you move those two to gas, how much would you save? I want to specifically know how much you would spend moving from diesel to gas, as well as what would the economic injection be. If you do not have economic injection figures, we can always get it again from you. And then, I know that in the third and the fourth round of bidding for IPP, the price was brought down to almost 62 cents per kWh, per kilowatt-hour, which is very competitive compared to Eskom's 102 cents. I don't know if it's still 102 cents, the current selling price. And then, last year it was expected for the IPP's fifth bidding round to be almost below 50 cents, which then would essentially bring the cost of IPPs almost less than half of what the average cost of supply is for ESCOM. So I wanted to find out, will there be another round of IPPs for energy from IPPs? If so, when the round will take place? Whether we know how much that round and how much we would then essentially buy from IPPs? And currently, how much is the economy in general in South Africa saving because of IPPs? Because as we see here from slide 8, that Northern Cape, Western Cape, Free State and Eastern Cape is heavily supporting the country in terms of IPPs. I know that the Western Cape figures will be coming up to 732 megawatts in the next 18 to 24 months. And because of these four provinces assisting the country with IPPs and so on, we don't
get to choose where the electricity goes. It's not like if you produce the amount that the Western can need, the Western can still get. Similarly in other provinces. So I would like to know how much IPP is in general contributing to South Africa in terms of savings. Then you mentioned the specifically the 4 billion rand that was overpaid for CLA. Who was the company? I want to know the company name. If that's really public knowledge. If it's part of a confidential investigation, then I'm happy with not knowing the name. But if it's not part of a confidential investigation, what are the company names? In terms of the new legislation regarding accounting office, I'm not sure if it also applies to public entities. That where you, if you find corruption or where there was a loss in a loss at the department, that the accounting officer ends up being responsible. Does it apply to ESCOM as well as an entity? And then finally, you mentioned that the customer's payment municipalities in some regards, but then the municipalities aren't paying ESCOM. And because ESCOM is getting paid, we do want to interrupt the municipalities then go to the customer and say, look, ESCOM doesn't want to give you electricity, then they get into the extension. Who are these municipalities who are getting the money but are not paying ESCOM?
Thank you, Jefferson. Who are the other two names? I'll give you the honest truth from my side. After the interviews that happened in the beginning of September, and a lot of people asked me that if I know it or not. If you ask me about the third person, then I'm not. So I spoke to the chairman, the acting chief executive, and he said to me, they interviewed 6 people that he will put forward, he has to discuss it with the board. I think it was discussed on the 18th of September, if I'm not mistaken, but I think, don't quote me, I think so, because actually we had a board meeting, and it was discussed at the board, and then 3 names, he said to me, will provide 3 names after the board meeting to our minister, shareholder. Now, I assume that has been done. The names that you are referring to, I have read in the newspapers as well. I had a call from one of them, and I'll just leave it. So who the other person is, I don't know. There's lots of speculation, and I don't know the speculation. So do I know for sure? I don't. Have I seen the 3 names? I have not. So I owe you an answer. So we are just a screen team, you know. We have new boss, maybe. Sile and Madupi, the payment. A question on Tiffany, that was on you. When we went to the board in 2006 and 2007, it was 78 billion for Madupi at the time. And a year later, a few months later, it was Sile for 82 billion. Those were the figures in my mind. Now, there are 2 figures for each and every project which I need to clarify. We call it a P50 price and a P80 price. Now, P50 means the 50% of the risks that we have identified materialize. So that's P50. And then the P80 is 80% of the risks that we have identified materialize. Now, currently, the budget, and it's a 2014 budget that we are still sticking to. The Medupi P50 is 134 billion, and the P80 is 145 billion. For Kusile, the P50 is 156 billion, and the P80 is 161 billion. But for Kusile, it already includes the fluid beds. Gas needs a rough meter for isolation. I always struggle with it. So they used to take in more sulfur out of the air. So it's already included in the CFS price. for Medupi, it still has to be built. And currently there is an estimate for that of another 40 billion. So the question is then, what happened between where we started and where the budget is? It's not the cost to completion. I'll not make it clear that I'm giving it now. It's budget. So, at the time, we didn't have time to plan the project properly. We were told we're in the crisis of the country, we need to implement these projects. So there were no 5 years that you had the luxury to really plan and design these projects. So when we went out on tender and started getting prices back, that's when we got the shock of our lives. Where these prices, and because we paid the prices on the last power station we built, which was Majuba at the time, and there's some escalation, but it was far apart from the reality. Having said this, it doesn't take away the fact that because we had inexperience implemented at the time, that we made significant mistakes that has costed us money. It doesn't take away the fact that there has been a tremendous amount of looting. So it is a case study on perhaps not how not to plan and just go and implement the project that you really need to. But we've taken this as a case study and see, should we proceed with this in future, how do you implement the project successfully? So I hope I've answered your question in terms of that. But again, I cannot quantify at this point in time what has been set aside because of inexperience and mistakes we've made. I can qualify the issue of the design issues, what has been looting, that is a difficult point. Angelus and Gerico, I don't have the savings on my fingertips, so I would suggest that we get back to you on that one. Should we convert from the open cycle to combined gas open cycle to the TCDD, combined GDD. What the same will be, I can let you have that, we'll make sure about that. Then your question also on the, you know, when we convert them from diesel to gas. How much is it going to cost approximately to convert? And then what is the saving going to be in terms of gas versus diesel? That we will get back to you. Your question on IPPs, maybe I didn't qualify one thing. Eskom's price is not that one that I'm interested. It's 89 cents. We are buying from the IPPs that they've more than doubled. I believe, Jefferson, this warrants a discussion on its own. And I would suggest and recommend that we get one of our specialists, whenever you have time again, to come and have a talk to you about the whole issue of IPPs. Because it's a fascinating topic to talk about, and I'm not that qualified. You know, I may be saying things that are completely not correct. So this is what, and then your question was, when is the next round? What the price is going to be? That is a difficult question to ask Eskom, because this process is done by the Department of Energy. So we are unfortunately on the side that whatever has been negotiated between the Department of Energy and the independent power producer, we need to buy that, whatever that power purchase agreement is. But I would really suggest that through OBI, we just invite that we come and talk about IPPs. The companies, the five names, I am unfortunately not at liberty to mention those because the investigations are ongoing and the SIU dealing with this, so unfortunately I'm not at liberty to deal with those. The issue of prudence of wasteful expenditure, do we measure that? Yes, we do. And obviously the Chief Financial Officer, my colleague, is standing far with all of this, but however we hold whichever leader and whichever division that happens accountable for that fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And within our annual report, you will see see that we actually quantify those amounts. So it's not that we're hiding that. So it's actually we. Then there was a question on municipalities. I don't know what your last question was on municipalities. Okay, there are none. It's pretty important. Let you talk, Chair, if I may.
So, Chair, I think just to give you comfort in this province, we only have one municipality that's on a plane management car, and they're sticking to that plane management. So, with Cape Verde doesn't have a municipal debt issue.
Okay, then I will have to come in, Chair. It's basically three provinces. Free State, Mpumalanga, and North West. So that's where the challenges are. And it started back in 2012. That's when it broke out. So the feedback that Monday gave me is about 24 significant contributors to this region. Okay.
Anything else? One more question?
I'm sure we can request to get the list of the unidentifiable. There is.
Is
it possible to get that to know where and what are the different UAVs at different times?
So, Chair, we put it to the 9,000 households that are not electrified. Yes, we can.
In order to have that implementation, if there is nothing else, there is a little problem of that, no? Okay. Thank you for coming through today. Thank you for your presentation. Discussing ESCOM is always a very challenging topic, specifically because of how big it is in terms of its contribution to the system or the possible difference to the system. And as your own slide has shown, that slide with the IPPs and the extra energy range that is also being produced shows that provinces don't get really much say in where the electricity goes. That depends on NERSA and the partners and the ministers. So, but the impact it has on our province in the Western Cape facility is 75,000 per day of per incidence of load shedding. And that for us is it's something that could have gone completely differently in our economy. In terms of the special appropriations bill, it's South Africa is going to be giving you guys a lot of money this bill is going to pass. And in the Western Cape alone, just cutting 13 billion from our budget over 3 years could have been 65 schools. So in every single portfolio, especially in this annual report season and budget season, you will find that every department will want more money to do more things and to provide more services. And even in the Western Cape, we have to now look at ways of cutting in order to assist ESCOM. And this is why it's so important for us to have a hand in here. We really need to also see where exactly is the money going. Because it's easy to say provinces must start giving money to national in order to give money to ESCOM. It's not so easy to go back to the ground and tell people that over 3 years we could have used that money for 65 schools. Thank you so much for being here. I do not think it will be the last time I will see you. And I will definitely request from the committee that we include as a resolution possibly to get special from the IDP stores and IDP to us. The committee will be invited to the department as well as the minister on the 19th of November to come and brief us as well. So should you come to the department, we should come on that particular day to come and hear what they have to say. You are welcome. Thank you. The committee will now go forward with its internal affairs and its current department manager.
Thank you.